Good morning, this is Orson Welles speaking. I flew into Boston early today on a rollicking tailwind, holding in my hand an immense butterfly net. Easter began somewhere up in the sky between New York and Massachusetts. According to my calculations, Connecticut, a busy and attractive state, rich in historical landmarks and natural resources, residents of Clare Luce and Chester Bowles. It's worth a visit or a broadcast any day. This morning, however, I bring from my journey across Connecticut little in the way of first-hand report, beyond a couple of updrafts and one tumultuous, timber-shivering air bump so violent that it almost broke the butterfly net. Of course, it isn't really a butterfly net, but that's what it looks like, and that's what it's been mostly called by people who've seen me carrying it in the street. To be quite truthful, it's a pigeon net. I use it to catch pigeons that weren't there before I caught them. See, it's very simple. It's a custom-built pigeon catcher, specially created for me by an orchestra leader named Richard Himber. It's about 6 feet long, very delicately contrived, so I had to give it the most loving care all the way from the LaGuardia airports. That's why I have so little to tell you about Connecticut, legal residence of Congresswoman Luce and price stabilizer Bowles. It's finally happened, you say. You who are still listening to these words, he's gone right out of his head. Well, you may be right, of course. Maybe I have gone berserk. This may be my last broadcast. And maybe this thing in front of me isn't a microphone at all. It's conceivable that I'm speaking solemnly into the handle of a mop and that this is not Station WCOP on St. James Avenue in Boston, Massachusetts, but rather some discreet loony bin tucked away in the Transvaal, a place of padded cells made to look like a broadcasting studio for unfortunate commentators who think they're Orson Welles. Or maybe I am Orson Welles, and I just think I'm a commentator. There's evidence in support of several theories. It's entirely possible that radio itself is a private delusion of my own, something I dreamed up here in solitary. The notion that I'm telling, the little grill box in front of me, is audible as far as Mexico and Canada is, on the face of it, pretty far-fetched. And the idea that people in South Dakota and Washington, D.C. are spending any part of this beautiful Easter Sunday paying attention to what I'm saying here is surely madness. But I figure as long as I know that, there's hope for me. If I'm sane, or at least if I'm on the air, if radio is not a gaudy aspect of personal dementia, if the darn thing really exists, if this is what the man says it is, a national hookup and not a pipeline to the doctor's office in a booby hatch, if I am on the air, and most improbable of all, if you're listening to me, then I say to you with all the cool authority of the sane that I came to Boston this Easter morning flying through the air and clinging like an overstuffed male witch to the handle of a magical pigeon net. That may be enough for you. You may believe that I've been flitting across New England with a long net in my hand, but it's imaginable that you count such behavior a trifle eccentric, and really, I can't blame you. I couldn't blame the folks at the field this morning who turned to stare when the pigeon catcher, the butterfly net, you call it whatever you want to, preceded me out of the plane. I didn't blame the cab driver for ogling, the traveling salesman in the Statler lobby for cracking wise, the elevator girl for giggling when I tripped over the handle. Man might bring to Boston on an Easter Sunday morning few objects less likely than a butterfly net. And the desk clerk at the hotel was so goggle-eyed at the spectacle, he gave me the wrong key. My deepest sympathy goes to the family who woke up to find me inadvertently catching pigeons in their bedroom. Nothing I can say seems quite adequate. But the explanation is as aggravatingly simple as a card trick, and here it is. Cole Porter and I have written a musical comedy from Jules Verne's Around the World in 80 Days. Pretty much at the last minute, a magician was written into the script, and lacking time to teach the technical side of the illusions we're using to the unmagical-minded actor who'll play the part on Broadway if we ever get there, I prevailed upon myself to saw the lady in half, to float her through space and produce a couple of goldfish bowls and a brace of pigeons from thin air. So that's how I came to Boston with a butterfly net, and that's where we came in. I only wish the news from Washington could be explained so easily. After all the facts are in, my pigeon catcher makes a kind of sense of its own. But the bill for extending price control, which doesn't extend price control, makes no sense. 4 days ago, after 12 hours of quiet hysteria, Congress gave price control another 9 months to live and tied a rosary of lead sinkers called amendments to its neck, tossed it out and turned to other things. The lawmakers who tacked on these new amendments might just as well have tacked green whiskers on their chins, dressed up in cap and bells or dominoes made out of the congressional record and run gibbering down Pennsylvania Avenue. Those lawmakers aren't appearing in a musical comedy, but they might just as well be. In the symbolic toga of the high elective office, they've made exactly no sense at all. The congressman who've just given the cost of living over to chaos might do better in baggy pants and with a touch of red on the nose. We'd know we were supposed to laugh. If we didn't like their jokes, we could walk out on them. But you can't walk out on inflation. The men behind those amendments aren't magicians. They've sawed our best, most wholesome hope for reconversion in half and thrown away the book of instructions. They don't know how to put the lady together again. They don't seem to want to. The stage is covered with blood, and they're out in front of the curtain taking bows. It's about as magical as a butcher shop. And as funny. What next? Well, if the House bill becomes a law, there'll be no more control on most farm products, the majority of basic industrial products, metals, textiles, rubber, leather, chemicals, coke, stone, and glass. If that House bill gets to be a law, it blows the ceilings off cars, electric iceboxes, and other things like that, things you want, things you won't be able to afford unless the price is anchored to the same planet as your income. But if your bread butter is just one item, but it's going to cost you twice what it does now, if that House bill gets to be a law, there'll be an immediate 50% increase in meat, a 50% increase in cheese, a 40% increase in canned foods. Get out a pencil and figure out your new household budget. If you have to be a magician, you be able to do that. Your household budget brings us to your house. If you pay rent for your house and that bill gets to be a law, you're in for trouble. Better figure now on paying a lot more, no matter what the men behind the amendments may be claiming to the contrary. If that bill gets to be a law, OPA is going to find rent control impossible. OPA cannot expect the landlords to sit still and behave, with living costs on a drunken balloon ride and the whole nation abandoned to an economic binge. Controls will have to go off steel if that bill with its amendments gets to be a law. And don't expect reasonable ceilings on refrigerators or automobiles or gas stoves or any other high-quantity steel items. The lid would blow off half to three-quarters of all major manufactured items. And what does that mean? Right away, it means wrecking the program for housing vets. Europe is starving. There isn't much chance for peace in this weary old world of ours if we don't send food, plenty of it, and right away to our neighbors, to their little hollow-eyed, spindly-legged children. This congressional extension of price control with all the new jokers on it takes the food away from those starving kids just as we're ready to set it down in front of them. If that House bill gets to be a law, food costs will take a quick rise, 35 to 40%, and that raises the percentage on the chances of war. Kids are going to have to go hungry. And there's that new suit of yours. Don't count on it. The cotton textile amendment on that House bill will take care of your new suit. Start saving for it now. Over here, we have the Crawford Amendment, eliminating cost absorption, the Crawford Amendment. Among other things, this little gimmick would add approximately $500 million to the consumer price of automobiles. Then there's the Profit Guarantee Amendment. Sounds pretty good in a press release by the NAM. Guarantees a profit on every item, which sounds just fine. Administratively, however, this amendment is impossible for OPA or any conceivable government agency. It would start a cycle of increases up and down the line. My best information is that 85% of the manufacturers don't have actual cost accounting figures available. The bill we've been talking about passed in the House of Representatives by a coalition of Southern Democrats interested in cotton and cotton speculation, and of Northern Republicans interested in short-term profits at the expense of the national economy. With its amendments, it means just this. No price control. Now, OPA has made and is making a lot of mistakes. It's occasionally restrictive and usually inconvenient, but no price control. That's something else again. Try adding that one up in terms of butter and the life expectancy of a baby. No price control. Put iceboxes and automobiles and world peace into your computations. The shadow of coming events is already dark on the land. The stock market has risen to the highest peak in 15 years. Speculation has increased. Goods are being hoarded. Warehouses are choked with short items. Consumers are starting to grab all the commodities they can. All this in the expectation of a boom inflationary period. And, of course, if the House bill gets to be a law, labor's going to come out for wage increases and more of them. Since VJ Day, remember, raises to labor have been based on a stable economy. Without that stability, we'll be strikebound. And, of course, the white-collar groups, the unorganized little fellow, will be hurt the most of all. Here it is, Easter Sunday. One of the gayest mornings of a year. The ladies are out with their fancy bonnets. A lot of the men folks look slightly uncomfortable in their tight new shoes. The kids are happy with their bunnies and their candy eggs. Main Street feels optimistic, and in Wall Street, too. They have a feeling of optimism. Matter of fact, they're feeling no pain. Many a swank corner hotel suite gentleman in Washington, now abed, are beginning to stir from a whiskey-clouded sleep. They have hangovers, but they're as happy as the kids with the candy eggs on the lawn. From their bosses in the financial marts, the telegrams have come in. Well done. In many Washington circles, there's rejoicing in death this Easter morning. The lobbyists have won again. The OPA is dead, and the hand that held the dagger and plunged it into the heart of the American consumer carries the label NAM. Experts in the government frankly forecast a 50% inflation by October 1st. The lobbyists from the far ends of the South, united with Wall Street, are losing no time doing the same job in the Senate that they did in the House. And what is Mr. Truman? What is Mr. Truman doing all the while? He and his fumbling reconversion director, Mr. Snyder, are taking a ride on the Potomac. Right now, there are more than 1,000 lobbyists working full-time against the OPA. It reminds you of the drive the power and utility lobbyists used to put on. Unless the people rise up in their righteous wrath and smack down these lobbyists, inflation will be well on the road to destroying this country of ours. And believe me, friends, there's trouble on another front, the food front. It's sagging badly. The administration has adopted a very unrealistic program here. I'd like to give a hand now to Fiorella LaGuardia for the wonderful way in which he's moved on the food crisis. Butch isn't fooling, and he knows his stuff. Nobody's fooling Butch either. He'll negotiate with the devil to get food, and he's doing just that. This food business is just another sample, of course, of how the lack of thinking and planning in the administration has brought us stumbling to our knees. And in the midst of a mess we could have avoided, the whole thing was obvious a year ago. But the administration closed its eyes, hoped it would all pass away. What does Mr. Truman need? He needs some real thinkers around him. He needs more professors and less poker players. Otherwise, all his fine words about following the Roosevelt plan will be as empty in practice as they often look in print. The inside story can be spelled out in a couple of words. This is an election year. The administration's afraid to cut down on food with the campaign coming up, so the boys in the back room have decided to muddle through. The Combined Food Board, composed of United States and Great Britain, controls the bulk of world food supply. But only nations which see eye to eye with American and British policies get what they need. America and Britain have brought the entire Argentine and Uruguayan linseed oil supply. This oil, approximately 150,000 tons of it, will go to make paint for ourselves and the British. If you want a reason why the Russians sent an economic mission to Peron's Buenos Aires, I don't think you need to look any further than that. Maybe we should call it the Combined Food Fraud. Now my time for broadcasting's run out. I'm off to the theater to watch them hang the scenery for our Friday opening, off to the crazy world of dress rehearsals, light cues and dance drills. And it does seem a long way from common sense reality, but I can't help insisting as I pick up my magical pigeon-catching butterfly net and start away that common sense reality is not the purpose of a musical comedy. It is the purpose of a Congress. The Southern Democrat, Republican, reactionary mixed chorus will now sing in close harmony their theme song. We got ours, who cares about you? Really isn't much of a number, but if we let them stay on with it, you can lay odds they'll stop the show. Well, thanks for listening. Please let me come to call again next Sunday. Till then, I remain as always, obediently yours.
The American Broadcasting Company and its affiliated stations have brought you the personal and individual news commentary of Orson Welles. This program came to you from Boston.
Next Sunday, daylight saving time goes into effect in some eastern and western communities. But this won't change your listening habits to Orson Welles. Your station has made special arrangements to broadcast this program at exactly the same time as you heard it today. Remember, Orson Welles on this station is heard at the same time each week. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.